Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to New Books and Biography, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Mark Clovis, your host for the channel. Today I'm speaking with Ian Kumikawa, author of the book The First Serious Optimist, A.C. Pigou and the Birth of Welfare Economics. Ian, welcome to New Books Network.
Thanks, Mark. Great to be here.
Well, it's great to have you on our show. I was wondering if you could start us off by telling our listeners something about yourself.
Sure. I'm a historian of economic thinking and of modern Britain and the British Empire. I am currently a postdoctoral fellow at the Center for History and Economics at Harvard University, and I just finished up my PhD from there as well.
Congratulations.
Thanks very much.
I was wondering if you could tell us what it was that led you to write a biography about Pigou.
Sure. Well, from a pretty early stage in my academic career, I was really interested in the interplay of politics and philosophy, especially ethics and science. And one of the places where I found this interplay particularly rich was in the history of economic thought. The history of economic thought in the early 20th century, and especially I became interested in Cambridge. Cambridge, England, the Cambridge School of Economics. So I was poking around in books about Cambridge School economics. This was even as an undergraduate, and just came across this. I was actually looking for an undergraduate paper topic, and I came across this work by A.C. Pigou called Socialism versus Capitalism, a book that was written in 1937, in which Pigou really lays out a very nuanced, short, popular, but nuanced comparison of the systems of socialism, capitalism. And that was really surprising because of what I knew of Pigou at that point, Keynes's foil, a more conservative voice. This was a much more nuanced and interesting exposition than I had anticipated. So it just led me down this rabbit hole of investigating Pigou's life, which is just fascinating, and I think I found was a really wonderful window into this world of economic thinking at this time.
I was thinking that as you were describing it, that comes across really well in the book. You capture how Cambridge is really at this moment of transition when it comes to economics and economic thinking. You're not just describing Pigou's life, you're describing the emergence of economics as this field of study. It's no longer just political economy as it was thought of in previous centuries. It's becoming a very different field. And as you described, Pigou is very much a part of that transformation.
That's right. It's becoming, economics at this point is becoming self-consciously a science. And that's where that third leg of the stool comes in. It's growing out of very, very strong ethical commitments that Pigou has. Pigou originally studies history and he reads very widely in utilitarian and idealist ethics. It's always meant to be in the 19th century, political economy is, in a sense, not unlike political theory today, or even government or political science today. It's a way about how to organize a vision or an understanding of how to organize society. But in the early 20th century, at Cambridge and elsewhere, science is really coming in. That the practitioners of this new discipline of economics are thinking of themselves as scientists in the way that Darwin and his followers were scientists for biology, creating a new thought system, a new general theory to describe the way the world works. So yes, those three things are really coming together at this point, and Pigou is right in the center of it.
So how does Pigou get to that point? What was his early life like? From what background did he come? And what was it that led him to go into economics at such an early stage?
Right. Well, what's really interesting about Pigou is that, and this isn't uncommon for people in his particular generation, is he actually went into economics relatively late. He only took his first, what we would consider to be a sort of economics course, in his second year in university. He was from a very upper middle class family with history in the empire. His grandfather was in India, and his on both sides there were people who were involved in imperial trade. He grew up in near Pembury in Pembury in Kent, and he went to Harrow, a very prestigious boarding school outside of London. And then to Cambridge, King's College, Cambridge, where he spent the rest of his really life, certainly the rest of his academic life. And there in this heady milieu, he encountered really all sorts of new ideas. He originally was interested in history, and he was attached to a circle of people who were trying to reform the history curriculum at Cambridge to make it much more professional along the lines of a German model. And he was always interested in this sort of rigor. But it wasn't until the second year where he becomes attached to the circle of Alfred Marshall, the great Cambridge economist, that he really takes a shine to economic theory. But his background originally was much more in the humanities, in ethics and history and letters.
So he is part of the circle. I was wondering if you could explain a bit about Marshall, because he's such a large figure. He appears in so much of the works of the time. He's very his life touches upon so many figures that are in Cambridge and are part of this transformation. And what is it that draws Pigou to him?
Well, it's an interesting story. I mean, I think Marshall is quietly charismatic. He is a person who makes very fast friendships, that is to say, very strong friendships. Marshall is a codifier. He is, by the time Pigou encounters him in the late 1890s, he is the person at Cambridge and in Britain who is understood to be the center of this new emerging way of thinking about economics, the built around marginalism. And if you take in first year economics, you see the supply and demand curves. Marshall is the one who really popularizes these concepts and formalizes them into codified systems. And he does this really by writing an incredibly influential textbook, Principles of Economics. So by the time Pigou encounters Marshall, Marshall is pretty famous. And Pigou, when he started at Cambridge, he was much more attached to the circle of this historian called Oscar Browning. And Browning was a larger-than-life Edwardian. He lived large. He had these big parties. He was really a social character. And Marshall was much more reserved. And you see, at some point through Pigou's undergraduate experience, Pigou is turning from this more vivacious bon vivant in Edwardian Britain into a more serious scholar. And Marshall and his friendship and his mentorship by Marshall is part of that turn.
I was wondering if you could perhaps explain what Marshall was championing in particular in terms of economic ideas and the degree to which Pigou himself adopted them, or was he developing his own thinking at a fairly early stage?
Well, at a very early stage, Pigou was very much a Marshallian. The Marshall was interested in creating a system of economic thought that was whole, that was not related to particular specific statistics that were being collected, that weren't just looking at local phenomenon, but were looking at economic laws, economic truths. And he called it the organon, a whole codified system of economic thinking built around, in a sense, psychological decisions that happen in everyone's minds. It was a theory of human thinking, human behavior, human social action, much more sweeping than what other, for instance, what the competing school of thought in Britain was at the time, the historical school. And Pigou, there were certain tools that went with this, the analysis of marginal costs and marginal benefits, supply and demand. And Pigou, in the early stages, as you would expect from an undergraduate and a very early postgraduate, was deploying these tools, not revolutionizing these tools, but deploying these tools to some new projects. Not breathtakingly new. And it wasn't really until the 1910 and afterwards that Pigou is creating really new and exciting ideas. But he is recognized as very early on as an incredibly skilled practitioner of Marshall's system.
It's also fascinating, as you describe in the book, how so many of these ideas have this very practical orientation. Like, he's not just talking about economics in an abstract way. He's not talking about pure theory or a very mathematically centric economics, but he's engaging with issues of industrial relations. He's thinking even at an early stage about welfare economics. He seems to be, for someone who has this life in academia, and as you describe, this reluctant engagement with official bodies that are trying to address these problems, he nonetheless does seem to spend a lot of his thinking in, you know, engaging with these problems and thinking about the impact of a lot of this stuff.
Right. This is something that ebbs and flows over the course of Pigou's career. At the beginning, he is young and he is very politically motivated. The big issue in the early, very early 20th century in Britain, certainly before 1906, is free trade. And Pigou is a dedicated free trader. And he is willing to publicly advocate on behalf of this really charged political issue. And he does so by deploying Marshallian tools, Marshallian ideas. And so in the early part of his career, before he becomes a professor, he becomes a professor in 1908, but before he becomes a professor, you can really see this synthesis of high theory and practical application. Now, he becomes a professor in 1908, and at that, he succeeds Marshall. Professorships are rare as hen's teeth at this point, and there really aren't very many professorships of economics in particular in Britain at this time. And so becoming a professor was an enormously big deal. And so when Pigou did this, he felt that he needed to cut out political advocacy. He felt he needed to cut out more clear-cut philosophical musings or ethical musings rather than what seemed to be much more rigorously economic investigations. And so all of this politics and ethics sort of takes a back seat in his writing. It is submerged under the surface of his economic analysis. But as we'll probably talk about later on, it comes out again later on in his life once the sort of value of professional objectivity changes in his mind.
And while he does as you point out, pull away from that in terms of his professional work, he nonetheless does remain engaged with events. And I'm thinking in particular about his position during the First World War, because yes, he's a person who doesn't have to take the stand that he does. He doesn't have to become a conscientious objector, but he does so anyway. I mean, I find that real world engagement, you kind of, it really pushes back against the stereotype of the detached Don living in his own, you know, world of thinking.
Right. So the First World War is a major turning point for Pigou, as it is for the rest of Britain, and certainly the rest of the rest of British liberalism. And Pigou very much is a liberal, and he belongs, before World War I, he is committed to these liberal ideas. He's committed to the improvement of the underprivileged. And by that I mean both the transfer of material resources, but also the moral improvement. He has a very paternalistic view toward the poor, in London's slums especially. And in fact, he writes early on in his career about how to improve the poor in London slums without ever going to the London slums. What happens? So, I mean, there's always a distance between Pigou's work and in his early career, his work on theoretically how to improve the lot of the underprivileged, and his actual life experience, which is in these very, very comfortable circumstances in Cambridge and in the Lake District. And World War I brings him into contact with people that he ordinarily wouldn't have been in contact with. He's not technically a conscientious objector, but he volunteers for service not with the armed forces, but with the Friends Ambulance Corps. So he is on the front in Flanders, and he is seeing all of this demonstration. He's working devastation. He writes really movingly about the shattered ruins of Ypres Cathedral, and he's working shoulder to shoulder in these really terrible circumstances with people from a wider range of social backgrounds. And what he sees, it makes him realize that, that the normal economic rules of the day, they fall down and they need to be brought in line with real ethical feeling. So he calls for a quite radical capital levy, for a wealth tax during World War I to help pay for the war, to make sure that the poor aren't burdened with the massive cost of the war. And he says that, you know, in this war, in the draft, everyone is being called to make huge sacrifices. You know, so many people are dying, and it makes sense to have, if there's going to be a draft on life, it also makes sense to have a draft on money. And so you can see here in World War I how his economic reasoning is so strongly influenced by his ethical commitments. And this is always true throughout his life, but it's especially right at the surface during World War I.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
He doesn't just serve As a volunteer with an ambulance corps, though, he also, at near the end of the war, goes into government service. He in particular is involved in a couple of commissions at the end of the war and the immediate aftermath of the war that point to that, that crossover from purely academic writing focus to the effort to try to apply it to policy. What was he doing during this period, and how does that shape his work?
Right. This is great. So toward the end of the war and in the immediate aftermath, Pigou is summoned to London. By this point, he is the professor of political economy at Cambridge. It's the arguably, if not the, then maybe the one of two very, very prestigious roles in Britain for an economist. So he has all of these credentials, and he's involved in several committees, one that deals with revamping the income tax, and two others that are involved with determinations about when and how Britain should return to the gold standard, which had been suspended during World War I. And so here is the chance for Pigou to put his scientific expertise, motivated by his ethical values, into real practice. You know, he writes in his, and I guess I should just back up for a second and say, his model of how to help, his model of how to be useful in society up until World War I was to be an incredibly respected expert. And then as this respected expert, someone who's seen as nonpartisan, someone who's not seen as motivated by fringe or even really deeply held ideological beliefs. And this is why he cuts out politics and ethics from his writing. He wants to have that scientific reputation, that scientific authority. And so his model is to leverage that scientific authority in just these sort of ways by talking to people in positions of real authority, real power, real political power, to get legislation or to get policies enacted. And so this is where you would expect everything is leading in Pigou's model of how to do his bit and help ameliorate the world. But when he gets to London, what he finds is that these committees are very pro forma. These committees are staffed with people who have been selected in order to sort of preordain what the result is going to be. I mean, everyone on these committees that push the government to return to the gold standard many of them are financiers, and they've been hand selected by treasury administrators who want to have a political cover to return to the gold standard early. And so Pigou basically sees that these administrators aren't, and Pigou agrees with this, but he sees that this isn't bureaucracy. He later writes how far from philosopher kings these bureaucrats are. And so he's really disenchanted with the state, and he becomes really disenchanted with the state as an apparatus to further the sort of policies that he would have planned. And he is on these committees incredibly disengaged. He goes to the first few, and then he goes off to Switzerland and hikes. He's a big alpinist. And so, World War I is a major point of disillusionment, not just for Pigou, obviously, for everyone, that this is what humanity is capable of. But for Pigou, it's both World War I, what he sees, the devastation in Belgium, but also the fact that he kind of loses faith in the state. He kind of loses faith in the government to be a real instrument of positive change. And he recovers that faith later in his life, but it's a powerfully disillusioning moment in Pigou's trajectory.
It's fascinating. He reaches this point right when he is simultaneously reaching what you describe as his point of greatest prominence, his greatest influence. He comes out in 1920 with The Economics of Welfare. He's writing and he seems to have a stature. Where is he in terms of the economic ideas of the time, and in particular with the one name in economics that is probably more familiar to people today than that of PIGU, which is John Maynard Keynes.
Right. So, in essence, after these government committees, through the mid-late 20s and 30s, PIGU is less active in public life than he had been before. He is very active at Cambridge. He teaches heavily. He's involved in shaping the curriculum for the economics faculty. But unlike Keynes, PIGU remains really in the ivory tower. Keynes is a man described by contemporaries, but you know, who know both of them, as really a man of the world, and whereas PIGU is a man cloistered at Cambridge. PIGU and Keynes go way back. They knew each other when PIGU was a fellow at King's, a quite young fellow at King's in the early 1900s, and Keynes was an undergraduate there. They, you know, would have dinner together. They would go to the same parties. PIGU was instrumental in getting Keynes, arguing for Keynes to get fellowship at King's College. So they're part of the same, very much small academic community. But Keynes's star is rising, not just within the world of British academia, but just within the world as a whole. He is publishing these incredible bestsellers, The Economic Consequences of the Peace after the Treaty of Versailles. And through this work, Keynes becomes a real household name, and you know, PIGU is not. Now, by the 30s, PIGU is back in government, working as an advisor to the government. And so whereas PIGU is very much sort of taking a hiatus from public service, Keynes is really stepping up. And this sort of sets the stage for the intellectual showdown is too melodramatic, but the intellectual real heated discussion that happens in the 30s around the time of the Great Depression.
I was wondering if you could elaborate upon that discussion that takes place, because you have this, you know, PIGU is sort of the has his greatest prestige in the 1920s. You describe how he begins to shift by the end of the decade towards dealing with more technical issues in terms of economics, and that you chart it with a greater pessimism. How does that clash with Keynes's ideas, especially when, as Keynes is, you know, laying the groundwork for the theories that, and begins to articulate the theories for which he is most commonly known today?
Right. I mean, we haven't talked much about PIGU's, the actual content of PIGU's economics. It's complicated because the thing that, so I guess the first thing to say is Keynes is thinking about this new way, the sort of what now is understood to be the birth of macroeconomics, this new way of understanding the role of the state in the economic health of the land or the polity, but also how to conceptualize the macro economy itself. And one of the big points that, in terms of policy prescriptions that Keynes is pushing for, is for the government to be much more actively involved in managing the economic health, the overall economic health of, you know, this thing called the economy. And so that means spending money, that means actively adjusting interest rates, that means for Keynes instituting a tariff. PIGU is understood to be, and basically if you had to reduce it to one big critique, one way of thinking about it is that the market isn't going to take care of itself. Now, PIGU is understood by Keynes, and he's called out by Keynes in Keynes's most famous book, The General Theory of Employment, Interest, and Money, as the most advanced example, the shining example of the so-called classical school of economics, which in caricature means that everything is going to take, the market is going to take care of itself. Now, Pigou didn't feel this way at all, but he definitely did think that wages would have to fall for the market to correct. And Keynes did not think this. And so there's this, but in short, Keynes is depicting Pigou as almost a straw man, at least this is how Pigou feels it, of being someone who just believes in the market working out. And this sparks a whole set of back and forths in economic journals in the 30s. But I should just back up and say that Pigou, the real contribution that Pigou had made to the history of economics in the 1910s and 1920s was to identify these market failures, really, when the market doesn't work out, what are now known as externalities, what Pigou called external diseconomies or external economies, where, in fact, the most famous example now is pollution. Pollution isn't necessarily going to be solved by just the market pricing it in a particular way. Somebody needs to come in and note that factory owners in Pigou's day are negatively impacting the social health and the social wealth of the community for their own profit. That the market itself wasn't going to just solve this negative problem. But that shouldn't take away from the fact that Pigou is really coming under great challenge from Keynes for being a representative of this perceived older way of thinking about economics.
It does seem that Keynes is picking out Pigou as a foil, and it's because Pigou does have that prominence. I mean, he is, after all, this, as you were saying, you don't have a whole lot of academic positions of great prominence in economics during this period. Pigou is one of them. And you make it clear as to just how it is a disservice to a lot of Pigou's thinking that he is more nuanced, and he's also evolving as well, as you describe when you get into the 1940s and his response to what was happening during the Second World War and then afterward with the Labour government.
Right. So the Pigou and Keynes are both liberals. Both understood to be liberals. What I found really fascinating about Pigou's story is that there's this wider history of what happens to liberalism in the early 20th century in Britain. That, you know, the Liberal Party is torn. It's torn between between people who want to be more reformist, who want to value the social welfare, people who are more interested in, at least in the early ways of how Pigou would think about it, valuing the social wheel over individual rights. I mean, the Liberal Party was always had this uneasy synthesis of valuing primary individual rights of individuals, but also valuing the collective well-being. And sometimes those two things are in conflict. And basically, there's this story that in the 1910s and certainly in the 1920s, the Liberal Party is sort of cleaved in half by those who are more committed to the individual rights aspect of things, and they sort of move toward the Conservative Party, and those who are more interested in the social welfare parts of things, and those are pushed more toward the Labour Party. And so in the words of one of Pigou's friends, Charles Masterman, the Liberal Party was crushed between the upper and nether millstones of privilege and revolt. So it sort of split. And what's interesting about this split is that Pigou actually, over the course of the 20s and 30s, and certainly by the 40s, is not moving towards the individual rights side of things. He's moving toward the social welfare side of things. He's moving increasingly by the 40s toward the Labour Party. And whereas Keynes is really not. And so there's this notion that Pigou is Keynes's foil, that he is representing this more conservative, older version of economics, and that Keynes is representing a new, more progressive, more left-leaning strand of economics. But actually, if you look at it, Pigou is moving toward the Labour Party, and he's doing this not least because of the influence of one of his really good friends, Philip Noel Baker, who is a Labour Party official. And so by the 40s, Pigou is, in his private correspondence with Noel Baker, is suggesting platforms for the Labour Party speeches that Noel Baker is going to give. He is really in full-throated support of Labour Party programs. And by the end of World War II, when the Labour Party is poised to win this election in 1945, that ultimately ushers in the post-war welfare state, Pigou is incredibly enthusiastic and very excited about the possibility that the government is going to do something for social welfare, recovering the sort of hope that he had lost in the during and the aftermath of World War I.
Does he feel that these sentiments are vindicated? Because he, unlike Keynes, who dies in 1946, Pigou lives until 1959. So he has a chance to not just see the life of the Attlee governments, but he also gets to see the welfare state establish itself, NHS, the nationalization and so forth. Does he feel that this time the government got it right, or was he disappointed with the outcome? And if so, why?
It's hard to tell exactly how vindicated or how excited he feels in the 50s. There's very little that survives of his writings from that time. But what is certain is that as things are happening in the 40s, he's very excited. And the tone of the writing that we do have definitely is more laden with the ethics and politics that we would see in the really early parts of his writing than in the sort of that interwar period where he's becoming a much more technical economist. By the end, there's this article that he writes in this philosophy journal, Diogenes, interdisciplinary social science philosophy journal, Diogenes. And he's credited by the editor of Diogenes as really having a formative intellectual role in forming the post-war welfare state. And I think he's very, I would imagine, I don't have definitive word on this, but he's, I think that must have been gratifying. I think that by the end, though, in his latest works that are published, there's a book called Income Revisited from the 50s, mid-50s, Pigou is coming out in favor of social policies, or at least social principles, that are so much more left-leaning and radical than he'd ever felt before. So, for instance, he makes this claim that really any sort of inequality, really profound inequality, is not a just way of allocating resources. And that's even if it's not inherited, even if everyone had the same opportunities, inequality on a massive scale, which obviously is, I should say, the inequality that existed in Britain at that time is less than the inequality that exists in the United States at this time, was not just. And that just goes so far beyond what he had written in the past. And I think it's not unreasonable to believe that that transformation in his thinking was due in large part to the example of the political trends that were happening after World War II, in the welfare state in particular.
And that's, for me, is what I find so fascinating about your book, which is that you write about this intellectual evolution that this very prominent figure undergoes. You're talking about a person who is able to reach and speak upon more deeply the trends of the 20th century than many of his contemporaries. And yet, unlike, again, I'll go back to the most obvious example of John Maynard Keynes, he's a name we just don't see talked about anymore. I mean, in 2008, Skidelsky comes out with this book. Basically the return of Keynesianism is being championed in the press, and still that's sort of the touchstone. And yet, what you describe is an intellectual commentary or an analysis of things that are arguably even more relevant in terms of the modern day political discourse than what Keynes and others were talking about back in the 1930s, 1940s.
Right. I there's a couple of explanations for that. The fact that Keynes and even Marshall get more historical and contemporary attention than Pigou. One is that Pigou burned most of his papers. Which is a very, this is a inside baseball historical historian's explanation of why that happened, the archival record. Keynes is also just much more charismatic. He's a much more charismatic thinker. He's a much more charismatic writer. He's a much more charismatic advocate for his ideas. I don't know if Pigou is more relevant than Keynes now, but certainly he is incredibly relevant. And I think people are talking about Pigou with regard to climate change, because this maybe hasn't come out in this conversation as much as it could have. Pigou is the one thinker whose work stands behind modern economic thinking about carbon taxes and ways of conceptualizing climate change in economic terms. And this is what externality theory does for the discipline of economics. And I think in popular thinking as well. And so I think you see Pigou's name mentioned more and more with regard to that, less with regard to inequality, although he is a major theorist of inequality. What is so striking about Pigou, though, is that he is responding to what he understands as some of the most important social and political questions of his time. And what's so striking is how familiar those social and political questions are. And I think that's why Pigou's work resonates so greatly today. It's because those social and political questions just haven't gone away. We're still grappling with environmental change. We're still grappling with inequality. We're still grappling with the real divergence between certain public interests and certain private interests. I think there's a lot in Pigou to speak to our present moment.
Mm. Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
Sure. My next project is about the growth of the British state in the early 20th century. It's also a history of economic thinking. It's not a history of economic thinking that concentrates on high economic thought, like Pigou's, that is to say, people who are understood as economists. It concentrates much more on the economic thinking of mid-level government administrators who are and business people who are staffing the British state and are adjuncts of the British state in the early 20th century. And it contends that the British state was growing really fast in order to render active assistance to British business in the early 20th century, between World War I and World War II especially, and that the British state is growing to also to take advantage of imperial markets and by deploying all sorts of imperial administrative expertise. So it's about the growth of the state and the way that intersects with business and the empire.
Sounds like a fascinating work, and I hope that when you complete it and it's published that we can have you back on the podcast to discuss it.
Well, that would be great.
Ian, thank you very much for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
You too. Thanks so much.